You're listening to the official EFL podcast.
Steve Jones inside the penalty area. Good cross. Mendonca! It's extraordinary! Absolutely extraordinary! A hat-trick for Clive Mendonca!
Oh, what an effort that is! A wonderful goal, Matthias! They're already warming to this man at Hillsborough, and that will do nothing to discourage the love from the Sheffield Wednesday fans. A wonderful goal!
Puts it into an area. Keogh! Zamora! Unbelievable!
Hi, this is Tranmere Rovers midfielder Neil Danz with an important message for everyone. Stay at home and protect the NHS. Let's save lives together.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the official EFL podcast and another two-part interview with a former EFL manager. Simon Grayson has won promotion four times from League One, including with his boyhood club Leeds United 10 years ago. He also won numerous promotions and the League Cup with Leicester City as a player. After losing his job at Blackpool earlier this season, I started by asking him whether he wants to get back into management.
I don't know. You get to 50 like I am now and you're thinking, do I want to go through sort of the pressure of being in the management again? On the other side of that, you're thinking, probably do, because it's all you've ever known. You do miss the buzz of being on the training ground with the players, match day situations, the highs and lows. I think the one thing that you've sort of experienced over the last few years of as a manager now is how it's changed dramatically in terms of social media, sort of the pressure, the time spell that you're given at clubs or not given at clubs, the instant results that people are wanting, and it puts extra pressure on everybody that is connected in the football industry. So I've had a good hit at it over the last few years. Do just see what happens in the future with it all.
Have you noticed that change since you've been managing as well? Obviously, there were quite a lot of managerial changes when you first came into management, but has that changed in that time as well?
Oh, look, it's changed dramatically even in the last two or three years, that social media now plays a massive part in football and society, that people can sit behind a keyboard and write whatever they want, and they can have a massive influence on decisions that football clubs make, or the welfare of a coach or a player, the negative, the positive side to it all. It's here to stay. Would I change it? Of course I would, because I don't think some of the things that get put out there are right or see the proper, have a fair reflection on what people are actually doing behind the scenes, whether it's a coach, manager or a player. The criticism is there for everybody to see. Nobody really writes too much about the positive sides in social media, do they? They all want a little bit of a bait to get some sort of debate going. But it's here, you've got to accept it. I'm not a massive user of social media, and I do say to my players and other people that I'm involved with, just if you're going to go on social media, accept that you're going to be criticised, and you've got to be strong enough to deal with these things, because I've seen players struggle with it because of the criticism that they've had, and they've actually had to come off it because of the negativity towards people. And sometimes, as I said earlier, people don't realise why decisions are made from coaches or managers or even what players are going through behind the scenes, that they can sometimes look at a situation and think, oh, the player's just turning up on a Saturday and he's missed an open goal or something like that. But they don't realise sometimes the personal problems that players are going through at that particular time that can sometimes have an effect on their performances as well. So it's tough, but it's here to stay, which is a shame. If everybody's a little bit more positive, then I would be a little bit more encouraging social media. Not that these podcasts are obviously detrimental to anybody's careers or anything like that.
But, exactly, I was going to say.
But Twitter and other sort of things can be as well, then.
But you sort of talked about sort of the mental side of it there as well. Is that something you've noticed in the game as well over your time like as a player and in management, how that approach towards the game has changed in terms of the attitude of some, you know, football clubs internally as well, in terms of how mental health issues are dealt with? Because obviously it's so prevalent in society now, people struggling with the mental health.
Well, definitely. Look, I think these problems have been there for many, many years, that people have had to deal with things. I just think probably when I look at it in the cold light of day, is that maybe when I started out in the 80s as a player, society, people were stronger. They dealt with situations maybe a little bit easier. I think maybe society people are a little bit more precious than they were back when we were all growing up, when we were all younger. But you've got to move with society and the times. And if people are struggling with mental health issues or many other issues, we've got to deal with them. We've got to reach out and support people. And that's why the AFL and many other professions are dealing with these situations, because it is more, it's a raising the awareness and ultimately trying to solve the problems that many, many people go through, where it wasn't probably highlighted as much in the 80s. People were probably going through the similar sort of problems. As I said, maybe not as much, but now it's such a part of social life that people have to be there for each other and help each other.
Is it something that you personally have to deal with at football club as well? Being the manager of a football club, is it something which you have to deal with on not necessarily a day-to-day basis, but it's part of the job, really?
Well, I think the biggest part for a manager is your man manager, your players. Forget your tactics and all coaching, etc. I do genuinely believe that the biggest part of a manager is your man manager, your players, how you treat them, what each individual needs to get the best out of them. Some need an arm around them, some need a little bit of encouragement or sterner words. But ultimately as well, I think we all now are doing things where you try and make it easier for players to respond and open up to things. We clubs that I've had recently, we've had psychologists in. Not you use the word psychologists, that's probably people use that, look at them type of people and will think that's a little bit too strong. Well, they're there to help people. They're not there because they've got major issues, but it's somebody else to talk to. Sometimes players don't want to just talk to a manager or your coaching staff. They want to go into a room and just discuss things that are private behind scenes and give people that opportunity to air their views, to help them with whatever problems they may have.
I'm going to get back into your management later on in the interview, but I just want to take you back to the very beginning now. I like to do these interviews quite chronologically. You obviously Leeds United fan growing up. Who inspired you to be a footballer and to get involved in the game?
Well, I think my dad was one of the biggest influence, to be fair. He was a school teacher, a PE teacher, played to a good level, football and cricket.
Yeah, because he got quite a sporting background as
well.
Yeah,
he was at Tottenham and a couple of other clubs, but back in them days, he went for trials at them clubs, but there wasn't the opportunity or the money really to go into it. So he wanted a secure job as a school teacher. But in that time, he was still running all the local area teams, North Yorkshire under 12s, 15s, 16s, and had a big part in a lot of players' careers. I think people like Michael Dawson and the Dawson family in general were close to where we grew up, and Dad coached them as well and managed the teams that he was involved in. And then he did the other side of it in the summer months. He was one of the biggest coaches at cricket in the North East, or the north of England, and he's taught the likes of Michael Vaughan and many, many other cricketers that have come through to the international scene. And it's sort of, he was a big influence, but he never once said to me and my brother, who obviously went into cricket, as played for Yorkshire Essex and got the odd cap for England, this is what I want you to do. It was our choices at the end. We had a great opportunity because during the summer holidays, he'd have the keys to the sports hall that we'd go in and practice the football and the cricket. And he did encourage us, teach us, showed us the values of what you need to do in the support, in the sports. But ultimately, it was our decisions, me and my brother, what we wanted to do. And up to 16, I could have been a cricketer maybe. I'd played for Yorkshire Skills, but the thought of somebody bowling at 90 miles an hour and ripping it around my head was not sort of my cup of tea. Football all day long. And on the reverse, Paul preferred that rather than going in for tackles like I used to do. So he guided us, but ultimately it was our choice, and we've been very fortunate as a family that we've been able to fulfil what we wanted to do when we were teenagers.
As we mentioned, they're a fan of Leeds growing up. Who was your sporting hero from that team, though? Because it was a bit of a, I suppose you probably missed, yeah, I suppose you missed the early 70s era, didn't you?
Yeah.
You towards the late 70s, 80s, where Leeds struggled a little bit.
Yeah, well, and I think that's why you would find it hard when you say about sort of icons of Leeds United, there wasn't too many around because it was such a bad time. And I used to go and watch other teams play as well at times. So when you look back on the Leeds team of there isn't one real player that you would say was the one that stood out for you. I think, if you were to be honest, when I'm looking back, I like to watch Liverpool play, and people like Kenny Dalglish were the heroes at that time. So Kenny Dalglish, even though he wasn't a Leeds player, was probably one of my heroes.
Yeah, if you look at look back at that Leeds team, like you said, not many, you know, of the players in that 70s team really got through to that era, did
not
they?
Not really, no. They're probably, not really remembered that well,
no,
are they?
No, no. I mean, Eddie Gray was probably past his peak by the time, I suppose, you watched Leeds play. But like I mentioned, you come from that sporting background. Was there ever a thought for you, though, that you, I know you've touched on it, but in terms of that cricket experience, obviously your brother, like you said, went on to do so well and went on to be a coach as well. Was there ever any thought for you to go into cricket? Did you have, you know, ambitions there as well? Or?
Not really, because I was always really, football was my number one sport. If it looked like I wasn't going to be given an apprenticeship at Leeds at 16, then it might have been something that in the year before I might have taken a little bit more seriously and worked a little bit harder at it. But at 14, I was a schoolboy at Leeds with always the intentions that I was probably going to get an apprenticeship. but there was still no guarantees that you're going to be able to make it in a career in it. And them 2 years as an apprentice at Leeds is, I look back with so much fondness and the experiences that have made me as a person. You leave home at 16, even though Bedo was an hour and a bit away from Leeds, you leave home at 16, it's like going into digs, and you're in digs with two or three other lads who were in your youth team. You then had the privilege, but also the grind of cleaning the dressing rooms of the coaches. And the coach there was Billy Bremner, who was one of the most famous players to have played for Leeds, an icon. And I would clean his boots, I'd be sweeping out his the dressing room where he got changed, the coaching staff, and I would take longer than I would ever imagine, because I was just listening to the stories. He'd be sat down talking to his other staff about maybe training, but then all of a sudden he'd go into the mode of what they did back in his day, playing and stuff like that. And it was like fascinating to listen to the stories. And the one thing about Billy was that he loved his football, that I would sweep the corridors, but there's this one area which was the gym area where sometimes you get like 15, 18 players in and just do a circle. The number of times that I would sweep it, that I'd mop it out, and then after I'd finished it, Billy would say, right, get the ball out, we're going to have a little circle again, like where you're chasing it in the middle. I'm like, I've just cleaned this up and I had to do it all again. And one of the memories that I got from when Billy was there at Leeds was we were doing a five-a-side, seven-a-side one day, and he stood in his suit with his shoes on and he's watching training happen for the youth team. And then all of a sudden, he joins in. He's playing in his suit and shoes and still the best player on the pitch. And that was just like Billy, because he loved his football. And it was fascinating that at 14, I was signed by Eddie Gray as a schoolboy. 16, signed as a pro by Billy Bremner. It was two of the icons of Leeds United.
Yeah, two real legends of the game there. I know most people listening will think of you as a manager, but how would you describe back then as a raw player what Simon Grayson was like to come up against?
Well, I was fortunate. I made my debut at 17, which was, I was playing the youth team on a Saturday, and then on the Tuesday night I went to this, got told that I was playing in the first team on the Tuesday night in a dour 0-0 draw. Came off after about 70 minutes with cramp, but I was always, like I've always tried to be for the last 30 odd years when I've been involved, appreciate that I'm in a very privileged position, but I was always a hard-working lad that wanted to do the best of his capabilities. And I think when I look at what I did, I wouldn't have minded as a manager having somebody like myself as a player, because one, I was a good professional, I thought. I could work hard in training every day. I would give my all. I wouldn't sort of sulk too much if I was left out of the team. So in a way, I always thought that as long as I give everything every day, whether it's a manager or as a player, then I could have no regrets in what I was going to do. And it was. I went through some tough times. I made my debut at 17 and only played probably another couple of times for Leeds until I was 21 and I moved to Leicester. But the growing up period that I had in that particular time and learnt so much about yourself, but from other people. Excuse me. At that time, Gordon Strachan came into Leeds, and Gordon had a massive influence on a lot of us young pros that were at Leeds at the time. That myself, Gary Speed, we signed at 14 together. I mean, Speedo and David Batty was another one that Gordon would just offer us advice. He'd give us a kick up the backside at times, because he might watch us in a reserve game and say, look, you're better than this, you can do that. And he was a major driving force under the young players that came through at Leeds at that particular time. But regarding my style of play, I played numerous positions, full-back, centre-midfield, centre-back, even then, and not carried that right the way through my career once I became a professional.
Yeah, I saw you put out a picture of Gordon Strachan and giving the referee some grief as well, yeah. So he didn't let anyone escape him, did he? But in terms of, you touched on your debut there, but what was that moment like for you when you did get to pull on that Leeds United shirt, obviously a boyhood dream?
It was, like when I got told on the Saturday that I was going to, on the Tuesday that I was going to be playing, it's all you dreamt about doing as somebody who wanted to be a footballer, to make your debut. Every player up and down the country, worldwide, will always remember the debut and how nervous you felt, how the game went. You don't always remember too much of it because it was like you're just caught up in the game and it just passes you by at times. And as I said, I can't remember too much about if I had too much influence at all. As I mentioned earlier, I just remember thinking, I've got cramp here, I'm going to have to come off soon because I'd run around like headless chicken trying to do the best you can. But I remember it was in the yellow kit with a Burton on the front, and it was a Leeds United icon shirt at that time.
So, was Vinnie Jones in the team at that time?
No, Vinnie didn't come to, no, he was 3 or 4 years later, yeah. On. So in that team, you'd have had people like Mervyn Day was in goal. I think John Stiles might have been alongside me in midfield. Pete had it. Just trying to think now, who else? Vince Hilaire might have been in it as well, Noel Blake. So there was sort of lads that had been round the block, but I didn't care who was alongside me. I know that nobody could ever take away that you'd made your debut for the team that you supported, and one tick was off the list of things that I wanted to try and accomplish when I started, when my heart was set on being a footballer.
Was it Billy Bremner as well who gave you your debut back then? Yeah. Yes, I'm guessing that must have been
I wore the number 4 shirt, which he wore all the time as well, and played in centre midfield. Unfortunately, I didn't play as many games for Leeds as Billy did.
No, just talk to us, well, obviously a lot gets talked about in terms of Leeds' history, the influence that Howard Wilkinson had during that time. What was that like? I mean, obviously you didn't play very much for him, did you? But what was the shift like when he did take over? Because obviously Leeds became successful again for that period.
Completely different. Billy was sort of relaxed about the whole situation. It was more seven aside, like they probably did under Don Revy and other sort of managers that Billy worked under. Where Howard came in, it was very structured, a lot more physical side of it, a lot more running, the players had to get fitter. There's a lot more work done on in terms of set pieces of how they were going to play. Probably Howard was a little bit ahead of his time compared to a lot of the coaches in that day, that he was very structured, organised what he was doing. And it took a bit of time for people to try and adjust to that. I remember David Batty would be in the team and Howard was wanting to do set pieces on a Friday before the game, and Bats would be just have this ball and be kicking it into the back of the net where Gordon's trying to take free kicks and corners. To come to the point that on a Friday, Howard just said to Bats, there's your ball, you go down to the bottom end, you know what you're doing, you're not disrupting the rest of the session. And that's sort of what Howard brought to the club and the organisation and the structure. And basically what he brought, a winning mentality to the group, which obviously laid the foundations for the success that he brought to the club.
And obviously went on to get promotion then, the title as well. But you left the club shortly before they won that last First Division title, as it was then. Was there any sense of regret or sadness about leaving the club during that season, or was it just you just really wanted to play?
No, I was realistic that I knew I was not going to play. I think Howard had brought in John Newsome, he brought in Ray Wallace, playing full-back at the time. Gary Kelly was just coming through as well, and I'd not played much over the years. So as much as I was part of the squad that was travelling around, I think if it was this day and age, I'd have been unused many, many times, because back then it was 1 and 2 subs. But ultimately, I knew that I had to go and start my career again. And I had a tear in my eye when I left. I got the call. The Leicester thing had been on the cards for a few months, and then it didn't quite happen. And as it happened, actually, I was subbed the night before down at QPR, and funny story is as Howard turned to the bench, he said, you two go and warm up. So got up, and as you can imagine, 3,000, 4,000 away fans in there. And they all started singing and cheering. So I turned to the lad on the right and said, "That'll be for me," in a joking sort of manner. And he didn't quite understand what I'd said. Anyway, the person to the right of me was Eric Cantona. So it was sort of quite ironic that I was my last day at Leeds United was with Eric as a sub, and got the call the next morning, went to pick my boots up and everything. I had a tear in my eye as I left, but certainly knew that I had to move on because I wanted to get my career on track. And as it panned out, 11 games or so later, after signing for Leicester, I'm in a playoff final.
Yeah, just, I mean, we'll get onto your relationship with the playoffs later on, but what was, you know, that first taste of it like for you, you know, compared to the majority of, you know, reserve team football, then to playing in a massive game like that, one of the, of course, even back then, probably one of the biggest games in football?
It was what I'd wanted to do from the 10, 11 league games that we had to then playing Cambridge, who were a good team in that semi-final. The likes of Dean Dublin, Lee Philpott, Phil Chappell and people like that. They were a good team at that time. And we knew that we were in for a tough game. And we beat them in the semi-final. I managed to contribute to one of the goals in the Houghton leg, the second leg. Then before you know it, you're thinking, wow, going to be playing at Wembley in front of 70-odd thousand in what is the equivalent of the Championship playoff final now, which is, as we all know, one of the biggest one-off games in sport. And to try and get to the Premier League, as it was going to be the following year, was going to be some incentive for us all. And again, I just remember that particular game, that it was red hot. I was marking Gordon Cowans, and Gordon was probably in his mid-30s, and he was as good as anybody on the day, and I was chasing him and I was like absolutely blowing because I couldn't get the ball off him. And at that time, Blackburn were the team that Dalglish Kenny was in charge of the team. Jack Walker had spent a lot of money for them to try and get out of the division, and they were the clear favourites. And unfortunately, we lost 1-0 to a dubious penalty. David Speedy, even to this day, he'll say that he dived and got Blackburn promoted. But a fantastic experience and a proud moment for your parents who've waited a long time to see you play in a big game. But ultimately then playing at the home of English football was fantastic for myself and all my family that were there that particular day.
Played under Brian Little as well.
Yeah.
I mean, someone who went on again to play for later in your career as well, Aston Villa. How much influence has he had on your career as well, and, you know, in taking it into management, I suppose, as well?
Yeah, but definitely. And I think all the managers that I worked under, I've tried to take out the good points and the bad points into my coaching and managing career. But
did you do that from a young age as well?
Yeah, I tried to take on board what people were saying, how I thought, trying to understand into the game. I just didn't turn up on a training and then disappear and not try and learn from everything that we did. And there's so many different types of people that you were learning from. But Brian played a big part in my career because he was the youth team coach at Middlesbrough when we used to play against them when I was at Leeds. And I said to him when he signed me on that particular day, when I was the Leicester manager, I said, "How come you knew about me in that?" He says, "Well, I've watched you in the reserves, but also I managed you. I was impressed when you played in the youth team against my teams and that." And that sort of his recognition of how he kept an eye on me for 2 or 3 years to see how I developed, and ultimately took the plunge and I think spent £50,000 on me, which doesn't sound a lot of money this day and age, but any money spent back in the early 90s was quite a bit of money. And so he did, he played a big part. Different type of character as a person, very laid back, sort of had great man management skills. And I loved working for him. And that period of time at Leicester, under him and other managers that came and went as well, I think in the 6 years I had at Leicester, we had four playoff finals, a relegation from the Premier League, and then a League Cup win as well. So it was a real
fantastic. A lot of trips to Wembley.
Yeah, it was. Like I said, the first year we'd lost to Blackburn, the second year we lost to Swindon, the third year we beat Derby, and I was fortunate that I was the captain that day. So again, another experience of being able to walk up them famous steps and lift a trophy. The first Leicester captain ever to win at Wembley was sort of seeing people playing FA Cup finals not win, and then to have that privilege of lifting a trophy. I wore a stupid beanie hat, which to this day I do regret wearing. But then the following year we got relegated from the Premier League. Then we got promoted again against Crystal Palace. I think Steve Claridge's shin won in the last 10 seconds extra time, which meant we got to the Premier League. And then the following year, we finished 9th or 10th in the Premier League and won the League Cup. And it was like everything happened for the Leicester supporters during them early years of the 90s. And even after that, when I left, they had two other visits to the League Cup final. It was an incredible time for Leicester City and for us as players, because we had a close bonded group of players that experienced a lot of lows by losing in the finals, but we had to experience a lot of highs as well by winning them.
And for you, I've touched on like your relationship with the playoffs, but what do you prefer, or what have you preferred more? Your experience as a player in those games, or as a manager, what's better out of the two, would you say? Different sort of pressures.
It's different, yeah, there's different pressure. As a player, you just concentrate on what you're trying to do within that team ethic of what you're... how you can influence it, what you're going to do for your teammate. Are you going to cover him? Are you going to make a tackle? Are you going to find a pass for him? So you are within that framework of the group. Whereas a manager, most of that work leading into the final is the key part of what you've done in terms of the match day, the preparation of the work that we're doing, the build-up to the game, how we're going to play, how, as a manager, you're going to control the emotions of the players. Because I remember the Blackburn game, it sort of passed me by, where I wanted to learn, get my players to feel that experience, what I've had, and try and pass that on to them. Say, look, we're here to work. Try not to influence have outside of interests and influences that can not allow you to perform the best capabilities. Because ultimately, you go into a final, and the only one thing you want to do is win it. And so, as a manager, you're doing all the preparation leading into game. It's like any other game as well, as a coach, as a manager. As soon as players cross that line, you are very sort of limited in what you can get across to the players, because especially in a playoff final, you've got 50, 60, 70,000 people there, so you're not going to get too much across to them. So it's what you've done in the build-up and at half-time and passing on your valuable experiences that you've learnt from as a player previously.
And as you say, in your final year at Leicester, winning the League Cup as well, and you scored the winning goal in the semi-finals as well, which obviously a lot of people won't know now. But just how special a year was that for you in general? I think you were player of the season that year as well. Just talk us through how you were as a player then. Was that you at your peak then? Was that the highlight of your career, would you say?
It was, being at Leicester was a memorable time for all the reasons that we've just spoke about, and the visits that we had to Wembley, and the competitions that we're involved in. And that particular year, 97, was a fantastic year, as you mentioned there, that I was playing regularly, scoring the semi-final of the FA Cup, and I didn't score many goals. So
must be the most important.
It certainly was, by a country mile, and all the other ones were insignificant, really. All the other 12, I think it was, or something like that. But I always remember Steve Claridge telling me when it went in, and I fell to the floor. People think I was doing a Jürgen Klinsmann. I didn't. I literally turned and fell, and then the lads just jumped on me. And he said, you don't want anybody else to score now, because you're going to get all the credit and all the headlines the next day. And that was Claridge. He was a striker, and they're all selfish looking for all the headlines. Us defenders just did the nitty-gritty. So you did that, and it was a fantastic feeling to score in a semi-final. But I always remember the build-up to the final, that we played Middlesbrough, who were Janino, Ravanelli, Emerson, and good British lads playing as well. They were going to be clear favourites. We played them at Filbert Street, and we were 3-0 down at half-time, and Martin O'Neill decided at the time at half-time that we had to make sure that we didn't lose by any more, because we were playing them a few weeks later. Psychologically, we could have really harmed us. So the second half of the game, he said to me, will you man-mark Janino? I'm like, great, at least it's only 45 minutes. Anyway, the game just panned out that we lost 3-0, I think it was. But the lead up to the final was all about, are we going to man-mark Janino? And I'm thinking, please, if we are, do not be me, because I don't envisage running around Wembley and just man-marking Janino because of the big open spaces and what job that you had to do. I would have done it because it's an unselfish task that you had to do for the team. But so about 2 days before, Martin named the team and he said, Pontus Kamak, you're going to man-mark Janino. And I'm like, oh, happy days, that'll do me. I can just play right back and do with the job and deal with whoever I need to be playing against and let Pontus go and Mark Janino, and he did a fantastic job, to be fair. And we went into the replay and fought and managed to come through as winners.
Yeah, the last replay as well in the League Cup final. Was that a bit strange going to Hillsborough? I suppose it's not the same feeling as going to Wembley, is it?
But I think if you ask any player, any supporter, we won the trophy, we lifted it up there and got to the top of the stairs, and you just turned to the cop end at Hillsborough, full of blue and white, and it was just a fantastic feeling. So, look, in an ideal world, you'd love to have won the trophy at Wembley, but we didn't score till late on, I think, and managed to nick the replay. So, look, you lifted the trophy up and...
That's all that people remember.
That's all people remember, definitely. Mm.
And then, of course, you earned that move to Aston Villa, after being the player of the season. How did the move come about? Obviously, we mentioned earlier Brian Little was a fan of yours.
Well, it was strange, really, because I was getting out of contract and went to see Martin a couple of times. And he said, look, we're in the middle of this run now of the League Cup that will sort your contract out. And so it got to sort of the back end of the season after the Cup had finished, and my agent would go down to Leicester to see Martin, and Martin had gone home. He'd forgot that we were having this meeting, and that was just Martin for you. He was quite sort of relaxed in what he did. And so it just got to the end of the season, and I had no intention that I'd be going anywhere else, because, as I said, Leicester was my home, enjoyed what we're doing. But then it just panned out that when Brian rung me and said, we want to sign you at Aston Villa. And when a club like Aston Villa, no disrespect to Leicester, was a top four club, they were in the top four, it qualified for Europe. It was just another, what I thought was another step up in where I wanted to get to as a player. And that summer, Aston Villa signed Stan Collymore for, I think it was £7.5 million. I went for just under £2 million, and it was sort of, right, this is another step up of maybe one I want to get to. I had aspirations of maybe trying to play for England as well, and maybe I thought by doing that, by going to Aston Villa, might allow me to do that. That never proved the case, and I probably wasn't good enough to play for England, but you've obviously got to try and set the benchmark high. And you go there, and I always remember ringing Martin up, because in them days you got out of contract, you could just walk out and you'd go to a tribunal unless you agreed a fee, whereas now there's people are doing this, doing that. And I rang Martin up to explain my decision, why I wanted to go to Aston Villa. Anyway, I got a message back from his secretary, which we can't repeat, of his reasons, telling me what I should be doing and what I shouldn't be doing. But that's just, he was disappointed because he wanted to keep me because I'd done well for him, and he'd done well for me as well. And the thing about Martin was, within 2-3 months of me going to Aston Villa, he was trying to buy me back again, which just shows you that he falls out with you for 3-4 months and then he tries to buy you back. And the ironic thing, I suppose, about it all was that I went to Aston Villa and the first game of the season was back at Filbert Street, and it was like, oh great, I'm going to get pelters from the manager, the players and some of the supporters, but that's just part and parcel of football.
It takes something special to score a goal, but it only takes 20 seconds to wash your hands. Stay at home, protect the NHS, save lives.
I mean, you've touched on Martin quite a lot there. I've heard a few stories about Martin in terms of his character. He could have peculiar methods, I should say. Were there any examples of that during his time at Leicester?
Oh yeah, plenty. And there'll be a few that we can't repeat on here as well. He was a throwback with Martin.
Nigel Clough influence, I'm guessing.
Brian Clough,
sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Massively. That Martin wasn't one for doing sort of loads and loads of coaching with a team. He had Steve Walford, who was a good coach, that would do that. John Robertson was his assistant, who was really the other side of the coin, that it was just 5-a-side, 7-a-side, give you days off. And Martin wouldn't turn up for training 2 or 3 days in a week. But the one thing that you knew was going to happen, when he walked onto that training pitch, training just went up 10-20% because of the aura that he had about him. And it's exactly, when you listen to people, what Brian Clough did as well. And we do things that you look back on now, you're thinking, we can't have done that as a player. We can't have gone into the League Cup final, go to Grantham for 2 days before the semi-final and not train. And it was like, but it just had this method that had worked for Brian Clough, that he thought worked for us, and it did. And that's why there's no correct way of dealing with training. It's getting the best out of your group of players. And we'd all run through a brick wall for Martin, and that's testament to sort of his ideas and his philosophies. We'd go to trips down to Bournemouth for 3 days, take a training kit, and we wouldn't train. And we'd go out socially, and he'd have a curfew for us, say 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, and you'd come back into the hotel. And we did. When he told us to do stuff, we stuck to that, more or less. But he would be sat in reception having a drink, and as we all came back, he'd made you all stay there, and he wouldn't let you go to bed until he said, right, you can go to bed now. So there was a curfew, but then there was another curfew once we got back into the hotel. And that was just his style, and it was great to work with.
And going back to your time though, Aston Villa, focusing on that, you mentioned earlier about the chance to play in Europe as well. What was that experience like for you? Obviously, you did quite well in the UEFA Cup that season.
Yeah,
against Atletico Madrid.
Yeah, I think we got to the quarter final in the end, and we played Bordeaux as well, and we're in Romania as well. And it was just a new experience for us all, and that's one of the reasons why I went.
It's a good one to tick off the career list, isn't
it? Yeah, to play in Europe against sort of some of the best players. I remember playing against a player called Kiko, who was a Spanish international at the time, and he didn't shout for the ball. We started this game, and all of a sudden there's whistling going off, and his teammates obviously responded to wherever he was on the pitch. Like, this whistle came out, and I think for 10 minutes, us as defenders are thinking, what's all this whistling going around? It was just a communication that he had with his teammates. But it was like you played against Bordeaux and Papin, the French international. It was just another level of sort of where you wanted to get to as a player.
And you worked, obviously, at Aston Villa for that season. Worked in a back four, which was, you know, quite a famous sort of back four, the likes of Hugo Ekiog, the likes of Gareth Southgate. What was it like to be part of such a strong unit like that?
Well, it was strange, really, because Brian Little, when I was at Leeds, I played midfield a lot, and only sort of when I got to about 20, I ended up playing right back. So then I went, so I'd be playing predominantly at right back in the latter stages at Leeds. Then I went to Leicester, and Brian put me back into midfield, and then Martin played me at right back, right wing back. And then I moved to Aston Villa, and Martin played me, sorry, so I'm getting confused. Brian played me at Leicester as a midfield player. Martin then moved me to right back and right wing back. And then Brian signed me for Aston Villa, and I played more times in midfield where I'd just been player of the year before, playing fullback. And it was because Gary Charles was playing at right back. So I'd play centre back in a three sometimes with Hugo and Gareth, Steve Staunton. We had some real good players at Aston Villa at that time that obviously have gone on to have fantastic careers in the Premier League, but as managers and coaches now as well. And it was a good group of players, and you try to have your influence on that team. But I think maybe at Leicester, I was probably more of a regular week in and week out, which probably when I went to Aston Villa, I found it a little bit more difficult to deal with because I was sometimes in and out of the team, and you might not get back in for 3 or 4 games, maybe longer. And it was sort of, that was a hard part to adjust to when you've played a long time, but certainly played with some good players and some good characters.
Was that part of the reason for moving on to Blackburn then? Was it just to get first team football?
Yeah, I had 2 years there, and Brian had left, and John Gregory, who was Brian's first team coach at Leicester at the time when I first signed, had gone off to manage and then came back as a coach and then took Brian's job. And the team had done well, but the club was evolving and moving on. The likes of Paul Merson had signed, Steve Watson had then been bought to play right back, and you got Alan Thompson midfield, and it was just moving on all the time. So I was enjoying being there and part of the group, but again, just as any time, you want to be playing. And my son had just been born that March time before I left in the summer. I just felt like it was an opportunity to move back home, or closer to home, to into the Blackburn area. So it all worked. Blackburn were a big club, even though just being relegated from the Premier League, they were going into the Championship to be one of the favourites to get back to the Premier League. So I didn't see it really as a step down. It was a step down, but I thought it would only be for 1 year, thinking that Blackburn might be back in the Premier League very quickly.
Mm. And that first season, obviously, you did play a lot of games, but after that, struggled again to get into the team. Was that, I know you mentioned moving back into the area. Was it a bit of a, again, a little bit of a regret to the move because of that? Because you had a lot of loan spells, obviously, after that.
Well, it's not until you sort of, you see things in a different light or hear things, why the reasons why certain things, and this again boils down to the things that I spoke about, that taking good things and good things and bad points from managers that I worked under. Brian Kidd signed me in the first place, but fortunately we didn't have a great start to the season. And Graham Souness came in, who had his own ideas, brought his own players in. And ultimately, you respect that, but you did want to be treated with a little bit respect. And there was a group of us that he felt were no need to his first team, that we'd go and train with a reserve team coach. And that group that was there, it was as good as we could have played out the first team at Blackburn and probably beat them. The likes of Billy McKinley, Nathan Blake, sometimes Lee Carsley, Christian Daly. These lads were, I got bought to Blackburn for £1 million, but people like Christian were 5-6 million, Lee Carsley, sometimes Nathan Blake was there, Egil Ostenstad was another one. And we had this group that were a little bit isolated and cast out at times, which I didn't agree with, and it's something that I've never really tried to do as a manager, because I feel that if you're there, you've still got to incorporate them. And if you don't play, well, that's just part and parcel of it, but I've never been one for really isolating it out players. And then you find out as well, once you leave the club, that there's a clause in my contract, if I played one more game, they had to go and play Aston Villa another couple of £100,000, which you don't realise at the time. And these things, I suppose, do happen in football that you can have no influence on at times. And you mentioned the loan deals that I went. I just wanted to go and play football. So I went to Stockport, who were in the Championship at the time, Sheffield Wednesday, Bradford, all in the Championship, because I wanted to, Notts County was another one, that I just wanted to go and play football. All I wanted to do was play football. I didn't want to be sat doing nothing, picking up my money, playing a reserve games, or just training six or seven of us, because that's not what you want to do.
Is that the worst thing about being a player, when you aren't getting picked and, you know, consistently week in, week out, you're watching other people on the pitch playing in front of?
Yeah, I always remember that one year when I wasn't part of the Blackburn squad, that the actual group got promoted back to the Premier League, and it was like, you couldn't be happy. I would not say I wasn't happy for my teammates, but you couldn't enjoy it because you were no part of it, you know what I mean? You weren't playing any games, you just had no sort of feeling for the club getting promoted. I was pleased for my teammates who I got on with, like Alan Kelly, Craig Short, Craig Ingram, and all them sort of lads. We're good lads and still remain in touch with now. But when you're not part of something, it doesn't feel that special moments. And it was a learning experience, but sometimes things are taken out of your hands, aren't they?
You eventually moved on to Blackpool after that. What was the thinking behind that move for you? Obviously, another step down into League One at the time, the equivalent of League
One.
Yeah,
well, it was one of them that I was, 31, 32, I think I was, that I had a chance to go to QPR, but I didn't want to, at that age, go down to London. I didn't want to sort of leave my newborn son, who was probably 3 or 4 then at the time. And Steve McMahon rang me and said, do you want to come and play at Blackpool? And at first you thought, I'm not quite sure, because I want to try and stay in the Championship. But I thought, well, it's close to home, let's see where it takes us. And 3 and a bit years of playing regular football, winning the LDV Cup at Cardiff, another great experience, and being captain of that group. And then ultimately playing regularly again and finishing your career, because I'd had enough of not playing. I just wanted to go and play somewhere, and it worked. That worked perfectly. And one of the thoughts was that I maybe would go into coaching sometime down the line, and that may be an opportunity for me.
How much did you enjoy captaining your teams as well, and especially captaining them to, you know, success, relative success, with, you know, you mentioned so many playoff finals you've played and obviously won the EFL Cup as well, EFL Trophy as well.
Yeah, look, I was always captain of the youth team when I was at Leeds, in front of Batty and Speed and people like that. Maybe people saw me that I was a leader, whether it is by example or by talking to people onto the pitch. Good, hopefully, that people would look up to me and think, well, he trains well in training every day and he's got a good influence on other people around him. I don't know. It was just something that I thought, or people thought that was quite good at doing. So
does he transfer into management as well, in terms of the transferable skills of being a captain to being a manager?
Yeah, I think so, because as a manager you've got these leadership qualities, and hopefully you've got them qualities that you need to take and express out to your players, and them leadership qualities as a player you can draw from. As you go into a managing side of it all, there's certainly a lot more instances you have to deal with, and they're completely different from a playing perspective. But even if I didn't have an armband on me when I was playing, it was always trying to influence, cajole players and get the best out of them, and use them experiences as a player then to learn from to go into my managing career.
And of course, that opportunity came at Blackpool as a caretaker. How does an opportunity like that present itself to you? Do you put yourself forward to be a caretaker, or what was the situation like?
Well, I certainly didn't put myself forward for it. I was doing all my badges at the time. And as it happened, Steve McMahon left one, I think, before the last game of the season. And Carl Oyston, the owner at the time, just said, look, it's the last game of the season. You're the most experienced player. Will you take the team? And so we went to Bristol City and had one day to take the training. So it wasn't, and there was nothing riding on the game. And I was still only 34, I think, something like that, maybe not even that. And enjoyed the day, but it was just one game. It was nothing. And then as it happened, people were saying, why don't you go for the job in the summer? But I wasn't ready for it. I'd done my badges. I'd not even taken any reserve games or anything like that. And then Colin Hendry came into the job, and I was out of contract as well. And he said, look, stay on, still play, predominantly want you here as a player, but also take the reserves. And it gave me an opportunity to learn how to deal with players that, I think most people find the hardest part as a coach is getting your ideas across and talking to players in general and in a dressing room as well. But didn't take too many of the sessions because it was more, I was still part of playing there. But it was a fantastic grooming experience for me, because
it's not the ideal situation, isn't it? It's becoming to...
Yeah, I remember the experiences of playing in the first team for Blackpool down at Bournemouth and getting home at 4 o'clock in the morning, having to drive to Bloomfield Road, unfortunately I had a 4x4, pick up the balls, bibs and cones, take some of the kit to I don't know, Rochdale or somewhere like that for a 1 o'clock kickoff, and I'm like shattered from the night before, full of the bag and setting out the kit in the dressing rooms. And this was sort of a real sort of experience of what might entail further down the line. And
Carl Washington getting his value for what
he certainly did for that. But it was an experience for me, because some managers now are fortunate that might just go, or maybe not fortunate, they can go straight from playing into first team management. But that certainly gave me an opportunity to experience what the real nitty gritty is. That you've got poles in your car, and all of a sudden you're driving and you slam on the gear and you're nearly hit by one of the poles that coming through the back of your car. It was an experience which certainly helped me for the rest of my career as a manager coach.
And you obviously eventually got the job as well. How did that sort of come about, you actually getting the job on a permanent basis after that, obviously in quite difficult circumstances as well?
Well, I was doing all my badges at the time and just learning from being the role of the reserve team manager. And then I just felt that, I think I was nearly 35, and I'm thinking, I want to do something different. I'm nearly ready for packing in playing. And I got a call from somebody and says, will you come and be my assistant manager? We'd been on the courses together. I just felt that it was the right time for me to do it. I could have played on for another year, but felt maybe in another year I might not get this opportunity to be a coach. So I thought, well, I'll do that. So I went to Colin Hendry and said to Colin, look, I've got this opportunity. I'm going to pack in playing. Do you mind if I take this decision? He says, no, but what you need to do is go and speak to Carl Oyston, the owner, and ask him for permission to cancel your contract. So I went to see Carl And I said to Carl, I've got this opportunity, can I go? And he went, no. And I was like amazed. I'm thinking, I've been quite loyal here. I've done the reserves. I've played over 100 games. And I said, why? He says, well, I'm sacking Colin and you're taking over. And that sort of, I fell into it. I never really thought that I would go from a player stroke reserve team manager to a first team manager. I thought I'd do the in-between, a first-team coach, assistant manager for somebody, and then see if I could take the next step to be a manager. But I was thrown into it. I didn't have any choice into it. And it was sort of, I thought, well, I've got this opportunity now as a caretaker. I either decide that I want to do it long-term and in the future, or I'll just do it a couple of games. And I just thought, why not give it the best shot? It's something that I've worked with doing my badges, that see where it can take me. And it wasn't easy, because I was going from a dressing room of some of my close friends to then dropping them on a Saturday and having to explain to them why I'm doing it. And it was like, I had to be ruthless in making them decisions, because no disrespect to them, if I was going to be a success, I had to make decisions that are not going to be ones that everybody's going to enjoy, but it's either going to be me successful in the job I want to do for a long term, or just keep friends with certain players. And hopefully the players that I wasn't picking were going to be respectful, that they knew exactly the reasons why I'm doing it. And it wasn't easy. I think it was November, December time I took over. It wasn't until the following summer that I kept the team up, and I got the job permanently. It was like a caretaker for 3 or 4 months. I must have thought it was going to be an easy job, because the first game was on Sky and we beat Scunthorpe. I think it was 5-2, 4-2 or something like that. I thought, oh, this managing career can't be too hard, because if it's going to be like this every week, then I'll take that. But got offered it in the summer on a permanent basis. And that's when you had to make some even more ruthless decisions. I was like letting players go. I wasn't extending the contracts who had been my best friends, because I thought they're not going to take this football club forward and do what I want to do. And I always remember one player saying to me, who I was friends with, I said, look, he said, you're not going to get a centre-half as good as me. So I reminded him a couple of years later. I says, I got two when I released you. I got signed two better centre-halves. And yeah, you just had to make decisions that were going to, well, prove to yourself that you could handle being a manager.
Do you make players speak differently at that point to you? Do you get them to call you gaffer? What's the situation there? Are you still Simon in the changing room? What's the situation?
Yeah, I didn't go from suddenly being a player to caretaker manager, right, you've got to call me gaffer, you've got to call me boss. I think it was more sort of...
I suppose it's quite awkward, isn't it?
Yeah. I think the one big thing that I did at the time was I brought Tony Parks in with me, who was caretaker manager, first team coach at Blackburn for a number of years, who I'd worked with. And he was my calming influence and would do things. So I think when Tony came in, it was all about sort of, right, this is now you're the first team manager. He would say maybe to the players, look, he's the manager now, he's not your mate, you've got to respect that this is what you've got to call him. So it wasn't sort of me saying, right, you've got to go and do this, call me this, that and the other. I think it's more Tony's influence on players that would suggest that what they need you to be calling me. Look, they call me manager, boss to my face. They're calling me plenty of other things behind it without a shadow of doubt.
Well, probably like most bosses.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Obviously
you secured that promotion as well, again, through the playoffs in your second season. Just tell me how proud of you were of that achievement. Now, looking back, obviously you've got a lot more experience as a manager now, but being a raw manager in League One at that time, how special was that for you?
Well, I don't think you expected something like to happen so quickly in your time. I said the previous season was all about staying up, and then we built this group together. But I remember my first 10 games at Blackpool as a permanent manager, I think I won 1 in 10. And 1 in 10 now would probably lead to you getting the sack. And back then you did get a lot more time to develop the group and try and get your ideas across and hopefully get over the difficult spells. And it was one of them seasons where momentum played a massive part in it. We were playing well at times, you get results, but it wasn't until probably the back end of that particular season that we won the last 7 games of the season on the trot and got into the playoff semi-finals, played Oldham, beat them both games. And so all of a sudden you go into Wembley in your first full season as a manager and played Yeovil and beat them 2-0. And it was like, to win 10 games on the trot at any stage of a season was a good achievement. But then to do it when it really mattered, the business end, that you'd 7 league wins, the playoffs and then the final, was just a great feeling to experience for a club that had not had a lot of success previously. But to do it so early in my career, it was like, wow, this is...
Did you think it was easy?
Well, I've now realised that managing isn't as easy as maybe in my early years. But it was a great feeling and immensely proud, because as a player, you do think about yourself. That's all you think about, really, and your teammates that you're out there on the pitch with. But as a manager, you've got the hopes and prayers of everybody on the pitch, to like however many supporters are out there supporting you, from your board of directors, your owners. There's a lot as you as a manager that is, all these decisions are in your hands of, can make or break a football club.
Yeah, a lot of important sort of responsibility you've got there, isn't there? You played in that first season in the Championship, kept the club up as well. Is that high on your list of achievements? Obviously, you know, Blackpool weren't expected to do well in the Championship, probably one of the favourites to go down at the time in terms of your budgets, etc.
Yeah, I think so. When any team get promoted, the realistic aim the following season to make sure is that you stay up. People of bigger clubs might have bigger ambitions and expectancy level. Really, if you can survive the next season, gives you a platform to build on, and that's what it did for a number of years. The one thing that you look back on is the players that you sort of you brought in and made them better players. You know what I mean? That you sort of you coached and you spotted a play and you thought that people didn't know about, really. I remember signing Wes Hula, and Wes, nobody knew about Wes. And somebody said to me, do you want to bring, I've got two players on that you can have on trial from Livingston. So I thought, yeah, I'll have a look at them. So they both played in the practice matches and trained with us. I thought, decent, these two. You do a little bit more digging and research on them. And you're thinking, well, two of them together might be a little bit more difficult to work with, in terms of two, one Irish, one Scottish lads. You're in Blackpool, which is known for its nights out. And I'm thinking, these two got a little bit of a reputation, but do I really need to have them together anyway? So I took that decision to sign Wes from Livingston. And the other one that I sent back, I ended up working with a few years later, was Robert Snodgrass.
Oh, wow.
So they weren't too bad players, but I just felt together, they might, as a young kids, they might just be a little bit sort of led astray. And Snodgrass always reminds me about that, even to this day.
Probably had quite an influence on both their careers.
Yeah. Well, and fantastic players, without a shadow of a doubt. But it wasn't just people like...
Quite similar players as well.
Yeah. Could manoeuvre a ball, could technically fantastic, could go... Wes more so at that particular time. The team at Blackpool at that time knew that Wes would play left wing, and you'd look around on the pitch and he's at right back, getting the ball off the right back, and all of a sudden he'd cross it. The team's out of shape because you haven't got a left winger, because Wes had gone and done whatever he wanted to. But the likes of Klaus Jorgens and Keith Sutton would then run across and fill in for him, because they knew that they would do that ugly side of the game, because Wes would win the game by finding a pass, scoring an important goal. But there's lots of other players within that group that you thought were equally as important. People like Michael Jackson, who was my captain, was a leader. He was my, as we talked about earlier, my, so when I was captain, I looked at him that he could do my job for me as a manager on the pitch, lead by example, run through a brick wall, nail one or two players when they weren't doing the jobs. And people like Andy Morell was an experienced player. We had a real good group that would run through a brick wall for me and enjoyed being part of together and being in this... part of this group that we're going to build and build. And all of a sudden you sign Ian Everett for 100,000 from QPR. And other lads that had come through playing, Keith Southern. A lot of these lads went on then to play in the Premier League many years later for Blackpool.
Is that one of the best things about being a manager? When you unearth a talent and you work within a budget and you find like real, you know, stars and, you know, players that go on to be icons at football clubs. You mentioned like Ian Everett there, obviously went on to play for Blackpool in the Premier League and do very well.
Yeah, I think you do get immensely proud of finding a player in the first place and then utilising his strengths and improving them. And once you see a player that you've bought for a small amount of money or on a free transfer, playing regularly at the highest level, but then ultimately sometimes then moving for a lot more money, you think, well, one, they deserve it because they're good lads and they've grasped an opportunity, but two, you've played a big part in their careers. And it was like another one, Kasper Gorks. We had the Latvian investment and I went out to Latvia a few times to watch players and brought Kasper over on a free, who ended up then going to play for Reading and QPR, and the club Blackpool made money off him. But as you mentioned there, he never 100,000 and played over 200-300 games probably for Blackpool. And it was, I think that's a big part when I look back on my career with a lot of the players that I've worked with, is the little gems that you've unearthed. And they've grasped their opportunity to further their career. Probably most notably recently was I paid £20,000, excuse me, when I was at Preston for Jordan Ugel. A few years later, he goes for £9 million to West Ham. And that makes you proud of what you've done. And there's lots of others of players that I've brought in for very little money. And then they've left for £3-4 million contracts and gone and played in the Premier League, which is really satisfying from my perspective.
Coming back to Blackpool and the season you kept them up in the Championship, the season after, you get the approach from Leeds United. Initially, you weren't given permission to speak to them. Just tell us how that situation panned out. Obviously, an attractive proposition, even with Leeds in the league below us.
Look, and I think that season and even the back end of the season before, I'd had a couple of opportunities to go to other clubs and I didn't want to leave because I was enjoying my time at Blackpool. But once the opportunity or the potential opportunity to go to Leeds came about, it was like something that I just did not want to slip by. And Gary McAllister left and my agent got a call, would I be interested? And I didn't need that any time to think about it, even though Leeds were in League One, Blackpool were in the Championship, halfway in the division. It was my dream to go and manage that football club, seeing as I'd supported them, played a couple of games, but then to go back as a manager was always going to be something that I never thought would actually happen. And then it got a little bit messy that Carl wouldn't accept the proposition from Leeds. I had to resign. Ken Bates sort of said, look, we'll deal with any of the and problems that come through it all. And it wasn't until a few months later, after a few lawyers' letters and things like that, that it all got resolved with some sort of compensation claim. But it was a day that signing and driving over to Leeds, I'll never forget. I remember thinking, how have I now just become the Leeds United manager after the greats of Dom Revie and Eddie Gray and Billy Bremner, Howard Wilkinson? And I thought, this is so surreal. But it was an opportunity that I was certainly not going to turn down because of my affinity with the football club.
Did you take sort of like a time sort of like take, and obviously you've thrust into a difficult situation at Leeds when you first came in, and we'll get onto that, but did you take any time to yourself? You mentioned there driving up to Leeds, but when you got there, just to sort of take it in terms of, you know, the facilities and the stadium in comparison to, obviously no disrespect to Blackpool, but It's a very big football club, isn't
it? Oh, of course it was. The thing about it is, as you know, that I knew everything about the club. I knew about the facilities. I knew the fan base. I knew exactly what they were doing. I was looking at the results every week to see what was happening. So I knew exactly what I was getting into. But I didn't probably have time to take stock of what the situation was. It was two days before Christmas. So it was all about getting in, getting signed, take a training session, train Christmas Day, play Boxing Day. It was all like a whirlwind that, God, this is some... My feet aren't going to touch the ground until probably May time, June time, when the summer holidays are around and I can take stock of the situation. So I remember doing all my press on, whatever night it was, Monday or Tuesday night, with my suit on and being in Elland Road, having all the pictures taken, thinking, this just isn't happening. I ain't the Leeds United manager, but it was to be the case.
And then your first game in charge, couldn't get much tougher, could it? Leicester, top of the league at the time, and I was at the game myself, and I remember the situation. Leeds had lost 5 games on the bounce going into that. Was it just about getting a result in that game to get yourself going?
Yeah, definitely. And as a manager, the first thing you want to do is to make sure that you don't lose your first game in charge. It was nearly a full house against Leicester, who were top of the division. And I just remember sort of hearing Marching On Together, which is played before the teams come out and when the teams are walking out, that you're walking down the tunnel again in my tracksuit, and it's like, what's happening to me? This isn't sort of what I maybe supposed to be doing, but it was, and I was just so desperate to make sure that we got off to a positive start, whether it was a draw or win the game. They went 1-0 up, and then I think Snodgrass came on as sub and scored the equaliser, and we got a point. And then I think we probably went to Stockport or somewhere like that a few games later and managed to get my first win. So we knew we had to stop the rot, however it meant, however it was to be, and then try and get the season back on track to try and ultimately get into the playoffs and see where it could take us.
How important is it, though, making that first impression at a football club? And, you know, getting, you know, it was a point, but a very crucial point. How important was it, like you've touched on there, the five games in a row before that Gary McAllister lost, how important was it to get that crowd on side as well? Because obviously Elland Road is a very toxic atmosphere when the team aren't doing so well.
Yeah, it was vital that we didn't lose a game, that we had to stop the rot very quickly and still try and play in a manner of trying to entertain and give their all. And the one thing that I knew about the club was that supporters wanted to see players running through a brick wall, whether they made a bad pass. What they wanted to see was a reaction from that player to go and get the ball back. Don't pull out of tackles. If you run yourself into the ground and you give an all and you lose a game, supporters will have a little bit of leeway with you. And that's what my key points were to the players. And I'm sure Gary had done exactly the same because he'd played for the club as well. So he knew what it meant as well. But I knew I had to try and influence that a little bit more on the players to say, right, you've got to earn the right to earn the respect from this group of supporters. And by working tirelessly and doing this, that and the other, you've got an opportunity. Because as much as there might be a little bit of negativity around the place at this moment in time, you suddenly get a couple of results and this place can turn, and this will be a place that the opposition will not want to come to in the future.
And you obviously go into the job, ninth in the league, I think Leeds were at the time, in League One, which obviously is not where Leeds United fans expect the club to be. Was there an expectation from you from the outset that you had to get promotion in that first season, or were you more realistic?
I think the expectancy was to at least to try and get into the playoffs, whether we got promoted or not. Once you got into the playoffs, then who knows what can happen at any playoff situation that you're involved in. It was making sure that you did your utmost to get in to the playoffs and then see where it took you. The last thing you needed to do was to finish any lower than you'd already were when you walked in the door. You had to make sure that you kept on improving and again try and do whatever is required to get the supporters back on side. So we managed to get into the playoffs by some difficult times as well. I remember going to Hereford and we lost at Hereford and the crowd really turned on the group of players and I got a little bit of stick. Players were being told not fit to wear the shirt. And remember me and Snods and Ian Miller, we had a long discussion with the players, and Hereford wasn't a great place at that time in terms of the dressing room, had wires coming out. Maybe the players maybe thought that they were too good to be going to places like Hereford. But what we did was we had a chat with a group of players and a few home truths came out that they either want to be part of this going forward or you can leave the door tomorrow, get out the door, move to another club where you can have maybe a more comfortable lifestyle and not play with any pressure as much. But if you want to be part of something that can be and probably will be successful in the future, then you've got to do more physically, mentally, you've got to be stronger, and we've got to go and show things. And I think after that, we went on a real good run that allowed us to get into the playoffs.
Yeah, and a lot of talented players in that team as well. Quite a lot of, probably say, raw talents as well when you look at the likes of, you know, like you mentioned, Robert Snodgrass and the likes of, you know, Fabian Delph coming through.
Yeah, Johnny Howson was around it.
Was that part of the, and obviously Leeds itself attracted to you in terms of the stature of the club, but was that part of the excitement of the opportunity as well that you had a talented group of players that you could mould into your own?
Look, I think I could have had 11 players that were probably the worst players in the club, in the country, and I would have still taken the job because it was Leeds United. Yes, of course, they had some talented players.
I'm saying, did it sort of, once you got there, did it excite you in terms of what you had available and what you could work with?
Oh, definitely. Like, you only, the one thing that you had was that when you were in the Championship, you don't always look at sort of what the division below is like and what you're doing, because you've got to concentrate on what you're doing at your particular club. But it isn't sometimes until you get to a club that you then work with the players, whether it's just a few days, that you can understand and realise that, wow, there's some good talented players now. We've got to do as a staff whatever we can to get the best out of this group. I think one of the big, you talk about the talented players, but again, I made a key signing in January straight away, that I signed Richard Naylor. Nails came in from Ipswich, was a Leeds lad through and through, that was a warrior. He was my Michael Jackson at Blackpool. I made him captain more or less straight away. He would run through a brick wall, he would do this, and he was your lieutenant on the pitch. And he knew what it meant to support Leeds and what an honour it was to play for them as well. And talk about the talented players, that, as I mentioned, but again, you need real true professionals with a hunger and a desire to get the best out of the group that you're working with as well.
And obviously you went on to get into the playoffs, lost out to Millwall, but did that give you the hunger this season after? Did that give the squad the hunger to maybe go one better?
Well, I think when you look back on the two playoff semi-finals, we go to Millwall and we come away with a 1-0 defeat, which you thought, we've got a chance here still in the second leg here. We're at home, full house. And we got an early goal, and the place was electric. The atmosphere was unbelievable under the lights. And we had a real head of steam that we really felt that we were going to go and get the second goal and put the tie to bed and we'd get to the final. Then all of a sudden, one of their defenders had a head injury, allegedly, or maybe not. But what it did was it took the wind out of our sails, and it sort of just stopped the momentum that we had. The crowd sort of, no fault of their own, that it, when somebody's down for 3 or 4 minutes, it just sort of, there's this lull, and we just couldn't pick it back up again to go and get that second goal. And then before you know it, Jimmy Abdu, never scored probably for Millwall that often, goes and scores, and it then made it more difficult for us because we were 2-1 down on aggregate, and we obviously we couldn't go through to the final. But what we did say in the dressing room afterwards, as you touched on, was we have got to use this now as a motivation for next year. We don't want to be suffering this disappointment of losing in a playoff semi-final, not being promoted, and having the disappointment of suffering the consequences again. Let's use this as a motivation individually, collectively as a group, to go to one step further and try and get promoted.
And obviously the year after starts so well. One of the key decisions, maybe, in hindsight looking back now, the club sold Fabian Delph. How vital was that for you to get that transfer funds as well from I think it was sold to Aston Villa at the time. How vital was that for you going into that season, having that extra cash available to be able to spend?
Well, there wasn't much. It was one of them things that it was always going to happen that Fab was going to leave, because he was such a talented player, and he goes to Aston Villa, Premier League, and you got the money for him. And look, there's a large proportion of that money went to do whatever it was doing, whether to part the ground, training ground, or whatever, or pay off debts, etc. But it did allow me to go and get a few players in to utilise to make the strong squad stronger. I think sometimes people can see an individual leave and then not see the squad benefit from it. But as a manager, if you agree to a decision to be made of a star player leaving that is going to help the squad by bringing 3 or 4 extra players in, which can lead to hopefully successful times, then sometimes you've got to make them decisions.
And I suppose it's probably not the case at a club like Leeds as much, but for the lower league clubs, developing those young players and then selling on for such a profit, it's vital, isn't it, going forward into, you know, what are challenging financial times at this level?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of clubs in the Football League have got a sole purpose of developing young players to sell on in the future, so their football club can be sustainable and survive when difficult times come along. So I think every club, from probably Championship downwards, and maybe one or two Championship clubs as it is at this moment in time, have got a purpose of trying to be successful as a football club and get promotions, but really is about surviving, developing young players and giving them the opportunity to have a career. But then if they're successful, then you can earn the rights of making millions or hundreds of thousands of pounds out of players that you've developed for nothing.
Well, that's it for this week's episode, but Leeds fans don't want to miss part two as we talk about this goal at Old Trafford.
Forward towards Beckford, and the ball's over Brown, and this is Beckford. He just ran away from him, but they're still going to strike it on goal and score at the Stretford end for Leeds United. And it doesn't get any better than that for a Leeds centre-forward. Jermaine Beckford gives Leeds the advantage at Old Trafford to the delight of their 9,000 travelling supporters. 19 minutes gone, and it's Simon Grayson going to spring the shock of the third round.
Yes, that's all to come in next week's episode, where Simon also discusses his ill-fated stint at Sunderland and that documentary. Make sure you like and subscribe to help other people find the show. Bye for now.